time to check your radio twice a year regularly. You'll be glad you did. Now here once again for Afro Radio is Doug Edwards.
1. On the 29th of July in 1943, my father died. On the same day, a few hours later, his last child was born. Over a month before this, while all our energies were concentrated in waiting for these events, there had been, in Detroit, one of the bloodiest race riots of the century. A few hours after my father's funeral, while he lay in state in the Undertaker's chapel, a race riot broke out in Harlem. On the morning of the 3rd of August, we drove my father to the graveyard through a wilderness of smashed plate glass. The day of my father's funeral had also been my 19th birthday. As we drove him to the graveyard, the spoils of injustice, anarchy, discontent, and hatred were all around us. It seemed to me that God himself had devised to mark my father's end the most sustained and brutally dissonant of codas. And it seemed to me, too, that the violence which rose all about us as my father left the world had been devised as a corrective for the pride of his eldest son. I had declined to believe in that apocalypse which had been central to my father's vision. Very well, life seemed to be saying, here is something that will certainly pass for an apocalypse until the real thing comes along. I had inclined to be contemptuous of my father for the conditions of his life, for the conditions of our lives. When his life had ended, I began to wonder about that life and also, in a new way, to be apprehensive about my own. I had not known my father very well. We had got on badly, partly because we shared, in our different fashions, the vice of stubborn pride. When he was dead, I realized that I had hardly ever spoken to him. When he had been dead a long time, I began to wish I had. It seems to be typical of life in America, where opportunities, real and fancied, are thicker than anywhere else on the globe, that the second generation has no time to talk to the first. No one, including my father, seems to have known exactly how old he was, but his mother had been born during slavery. He was of the first generation of free men. He, along with thousands of other Negroes, came north after 1919, and I was part of that generation, which had never seen the landscape of what Negroes sometimes called the old country. He had been born in New Orleans, and had been quite a young man there during the time that Louis Armstrong, a boy, was running errands for the dives and the honky-tonks of what was always presented to me as one of the most of wicked cities. To this day, whenever I think of New Orleans, I also helplessly think of Sodom and Gomorrah. My father never mentioned Louis Armstrong, except to forbid us to play his records. But there was a picture of him on our wall for a long time. One of my father's strong-willed female relatives had placed it there and forbade my father to take it down. He never did. But he eventually maneuvered her out of the house, and when, some years later, she was in trouble and near death, he refused to do anything to help her. He was, I think, very handsome. I gathered this from photographs and from my own memories of him, dressed in his Sunday best and on his way to preach a sermon somewhere when I was little. Handsome, proud, and ingrown. Like a toenail, somebody said. But he looked to me, as I grew older, like pictures I had seen of African tribal chieftains. He really should have been naked, with war paint on and barbaric mementos, standing among spears. He could be chilling in the pulpit and indescribably cruel in his personal life, and he was certainly the most bitter man I have ever met. Yet, it must be said that there was something else in him, buried in him, which lent him his tremendous power and even a rather crushing charm. It had something to do with his blackness, I think. He was very black, with his blackness and his beauty and with the fact that he knew that he was black but did not know that he was beautiful. He claimed to be proud of his blackness, but it had also been the cause of much humiliation, and it had fixed bleak boundaries to his life. He was not a young man when we were growing up, and he had already suffered many kinds of ruin. In his outrageously demanding and protective way, he loved his children, who were black like him and menaced like him. And all of these things sometimes showed in his face when he tried, never to my knowledge with any success, to establish contact with any of us. When he took one of his children on his knee to play, the child always became fretful and began to cry. When he tried to help one of us with our homework, the absolutely unabating tension which emanated from him caused our minds and our tongues to become paralyzed, so that he, scarcely knowing why, flew into a rage, and the child, not knowing why, was punished. If it ever entered his head to bring a surprise home for his children, it was almost, unfailingly, the wrong surprise, and even the big watermelons he often brought home on his back in the summertime led to the most appalling scenes. I do not remember, in all those years, that one of his children was ever glad to see him come home. From what I was able to gather of his early life, it seemed that his inability to establish contact with other people had always marked him and had been one of the things which had driven him out of New Orleans. There was something in him, therefore, groping and tentative, which was never expressed and which was buried with him. One saw it most clearly when he was facing new people and hoping to impress them. But he never did, not for long. We went from church to smaller and more improbable church. He found himself in less and less demand as a minister. By the time he died, none of his friends had come to see him for a long time. He had lived and died in an intolerable bitterness of spirit, and it frightened me as we drove him to the graveyard through those unquiet, ruined streets, to see how powerful and overflowing this bitterness could be, and to realize that this bitterness now was mine.
He declined, however, to amplify on his remarks, although it varies considerably each year in different regions.